You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, no question about it, digital technology has infused our lives. And while it brings many benefits, we are paying a price for having our brains constantly plugged into this digital world. At special risk, children and adolescents. But let's talk about the effect of screen time on kids and parents and what we should do about it. We turn now to Scott Becker and Aislinn Sapp. Scott's director of the Counseling Center at Michigan State University. Aislinn is with the Office of Student Affairs and Services at MSU. Aislinn, to be fair, before we get into the negative side effects of digital technology, social media, video games, apps, what do you see as some of the positive things about it in terms of mental health?
Certainly access is probably one of the biggest positive things I see. You know, it provides people who either are geographically isolated with a way into treatment or a way into help seeking. It's also really important in terms of lowering the stigma and lowering that threshold of access. So we do know that, you know, people who won't walk into a counseling center, for example, and say, I need some help, might answer or write an email about it or look on a blog or send a tweet or text someone if they're feeling upset, suicidal, overwhelmed, in crisis. So certainly in terms of that first entryway into services, there's a lot of positives. There's a lot of support that can happen in terms of online community. People with certain diagnoses or who are living and struggling with certain mental health conditions can find a lot of support online in terms of that community and that sense of belonging and finding, you know, kids who are growing up maybe in a region of the country where they don't have a lot of people like themselves, that can really be a lifesaver, finding that access online.
So we can kind of use digital technology to help create and sustain a sense of community and intimacy, which is good. But now, Scott, let's flip the coin. What is digital technology doing that has more kids seeking help for mental health issues? How's it affecting them?
What we're finding is that the critical deficit that's happening is in the right hemisphere, which generally speaking influences emotion regulation, memory, impulse control, and it's also the integration between the right hemisphere, which governs emotions, and the left hemisphere, which is logic and impulse control. So what we're seeing are underdeveloped capacities for understanding our feelings, for naming them, for communicating those to other people, and really for putting on the emotional breaks. There's less of a capacity to self-soothe. That's one of the terms in psychotherapy. And so emotion regulation, impulse control, distress tolerance is lower than it used to be. So a similar situation that a student might have faced 10 or 20 years ago and was manageable then is not as manageable now. So we're seeing students coming in with panic episodes and with chronic distress related to a lack of social connection. So we're seeing social media replacing face-to-face communication, which, if we now look at the developmental literature, is the way in which a lot of these emotional structures develop. Aislinn is a developmental specialist, and I'll let her address some of that. But what we're seeing is the absence of adequate levels of social interaction are causing some of these problems.
I got to imagine sleep has got to be an issue, because I know these kids are going to, you know, they've got the phone next to them in bed. They're waking up during the night checking messages. That has to affect brains, right?
Absolutely, it does. You know, sleep is one of the most important things in terms of, I mean, for all of us, but certainly if you think about the developing brain, there's not much that's more important outside of, you know, nutrition, safety. Sleep is right up there. And there are a lot of factors there. There's the one you just mentioned, that kind of fear of missing out. So I'm checking the phone all night long. That happens to adults who have jobs, who feel like they can't miss an email or who might legitimately be on call. And then there's also issues with, you know, the blue light from the phone. There's a lot of research to suggest that that actually knocks down your melatonin, which is one of the things that's responsible for sleep onset. And so there are actual kind of physiological consequences to having these phones kind of right next to our beds all night long.
So we need to talk about first the little ones before we talk about the older ones, because how do we as parents or as caring grandparents keep this from happening when we have little ones in our care, so that it doesn't get to the point that you're seeing with these students coming in? What should be the guidelines for parents of youngsters, little ones?
I think the bottom line is as little screen time as absolutely possible. We have kids. Our kids are 8 and a half and just turned 6, and they are certainly, they get TV time. You know, they even have tablets, but we are very, very conservative with respect to how much time they get. And we're very mindful of the balance between how much of their life is lived online and how much of their life is lived in the real world. And so, you know, we go outside, we play, we do not have any devices in the car, we don't have any devices at the dinner table, we watch TV with them, we talk to them, we make sure that they're living life in a real 3D world rather than primarily in an online setting.
I would just add that the first thing we recommend to parents and anyone working with kids is to examine their own levels of use.
Sure.
What the research is showing is that most people use much more than they realize, not just for work, not just sitting in front of a desktop and sending emails and finding information, but outside of work. And so the first thing would be to do what in AA is called a fearless and searching moral inventory, and really looking at the number of times a day that even short, let's say checking text messages, even short interruptions, how that impacts relationships and communication and satisfaction throughout the day, and focus, really, and the way it impacts parenting.
I've seen people pushing strollers, and mm-hmm. as they're pushing strollers, spending what should be time with their little one, they're texting. They're doing.
Yep.
They're pecking away at their smartphone.
Yep. We
see it in restaurants. You see them. You know,
yep.
The phone is not out of the hand, so that has to have an effect. Being a digitally distracted parent on the child.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, and you see it, you know, oftentimes if the kids aren't on their own devices, which as we've talked about is its own kind of problem, then they're escalating their own behavior in order to get the attention that they're not getting from their parents. You know, they need that one-on-one eye contact is so huge. Actually looking at a child when they ask you a question and answering the question, or getting down and playing with your kids, being with them when you're supposed to be with them, is really important.
So I do hear a very clear challenge that parents need to look in the mirror and
yeah.
really do this self-analysis. What about, Scott, when we talk about middle school, high school, these, as they're getting set up for college and careers, how should parents approach talking to their teens about screen time and maybe reversing things that have been building for years?
Well, we encourage conversation. We encourage sharing information. We do an hour and a half or sometimes a 3-hour workshop for schools and for parent groups. And what we're telling folks is, at a certain point, your teenager is going to do what they're going to do. And so the goal is to influence their decision-making, not just their behavior. So saying no while they're in your house is one thing, but it can build up resentment and an adversarial relationship. So what we're encouraging is share a version of this information with your kids and gear it toward whatever developmental level they happen to be at the moment. But make sure that they understand why you're saying no and why you're saying yes mm-hmm. to other things. And encouraging them really to extend that conversation to their friends. If they're the only, say, eighth grader who's unplugging, likely, especially at first, they're going to feel rather isolated and alone and potentially ostracized because they're not on social media where, quote unquote, everything is happening. So this has to be done in conversation within the family. And then I think ultimately has to be in conversation with other families, with other parents, with other kids, so that there's a countercultural sort of a movement that gets started. And there's a sense of social connection that happens off of the devices. Without that, it's difficult to replace something that is, in many ways, quite literally addictive.
I would just add to what Scott said, you know, especially as kids get into high school and are moving on into college, the importance of talking with your kids about technology as a tool. I mean, this isn't going to go away. We need to be tech skilled in order to work in just about any field these days. But, you know, teenagers are still learning, and it's still very hard for them when they're upset, for example, or excited to put on the brakes. And so really teaching them about the fact that, you know, when you put something out there on Facebook, there's no guarantee you're ever going to get it off of Facebook. So that long-term thinking about what's that going to look like if a potential employer is researching your digital presence, and also really highlighting for them that 60% of communication is nonverbal. And so if you're trying to have an interaction with your friend, there are some things that are just better to do in person or over the phone where you can hear the tone of their voice, where you're not going to misunderstand what they're saying. So giving them that skill set to say, you know what, maybe we shouldn't be talking about this on a Facebook chat. Can I call you?
Or a
because
text.
I'm not sure.
If I had a nickel for any every time I have said to...
Yep.
My kid, call them so you
yes.
could hear voices, the fights and the problems that can happen
yes.
because of that text message that has
yep.
no sense of context, no tone of voice.
Exactly.
What
yep.
is neuroplasticity and how would that help both kids and adults recover from being addicted to our technology?
So kind of just basic neuroplasticity really refers to the ability of the human brain to reshape itself in response to experiences. So the idea that we are actually making new connections in the brain throughout the lifespan. We used to think that it was kind of primarily limited to childhood. And what we know now is even as adults, our brains are always adapting and changing to the environments that we put them in. And so with respect to technology, the more you use that as your primary means of interacting with the world, the more your brain's going to adapt to that in ways that Scott has kind of pointed out can become problematical. But the more we move away from that or move towards a more balanced lifestyle, the more our brains are going to adapt to that. And particularly with respect to kids, you know, the changes we see in kids are most profound, but they're also the easiest to correct the younger that they are. So the sooner you get them off the device, there's a lot of kind of research that looks at kids who do, let's say, tech-free camps for a week or two in the summer. And they show by the end of those 2 weeks, decreases in anxiety, increases in empathy, increases in positive affect. So the changes can be pretty dramatic and pretty quick with even just a few small changes.
Scott, do you worry that it's too late for us to get our arms around this?
Yes, at times I do. My fear is that the forces that are generating the technology are so endemic to the culture, they're so global, and they're so, I alluded to addiction earlier, they're designed to be addictive. There's a lab, for example, at Stanford, and app and web designers go there to learn how to make their programs more physiologically addictive. So the product that's being sold is not, as Aislinn said, just a tool. It can be used as a tool, but the minute we slide into social media and other forms of media consumption, there's a sense in which we need more and more of it, or our bodies come to think that they do. So there are times when I feel that because this is the water we're swimming in, because everyone's drug is in their front pocket, that this is going to take a rather global, rather pronounced effort on everybody's part to unplug and to become aware. So the good news is there are a lot of researchers and journalists and writers looking at this issue and getting the word out, educators as well. So I think there can be a positive tipping point. We're just trying to be part of that conversation.
Scott Becker and Aislinn Sapp from Michigan State University, thank you so much for speaking with us and giving parents a lot of food for thought.
Thank you.
Thank you.